Such a cynosure, at least in aspect, and something such too in nature, though with important variations made apparent as the story proceeds, was Welkin-eyed Billy Budd, or Baby Budd, as more familiarly under the circumstances hereafter to be given, he came at last to be called. Age 21, a foretopman of the fleet toward the close of the last decade of the 18th century. It was not very long prior to the time of the narration that follows that he had entered the king's service, having been impressed on the narrow seas from a homeward-bound English merchantman into a 74 outward-bound HMS Indomitable, which ship, as was not unusual in those hurried days, had been obliged to put to sea short of her proper complement of men. Plump upon Billy at the first sight in the gangway, the boarding officer, Lieutenant Ratcliffe, pounced, even before the merchantman's crew formally was mustered on the quarter-deck for his deliberate inspection. And him only he selected, for whether it was because the other men, when ranged before him, showed to ill advantage after Billy, or whether he had some scruples in view of the merchantman being rather short-handed, however it might be, the officer contented himself with his first spontaneous choice. To the surprise of the ship's company, though much to the lieutenant's satisfaction, Billy made no demur. But, indeed, any demur would have been as idle as the protest of a goldfinch popped into a cage. Noting this uncomplaining acquiescence, all but cheerful, one might say, the shipmates turned a surprised glance of silent reproach at the sailor. A shipmaster was one of those worthy mortals found in every vocation, even the humbler ones, the sort of person whom everybody agrees in calling a respectable man. And, nor so strange to report as it may appear to be, though a ploughman of the troubled waters, lifelong contending with the intractable elements, there was nothing this honest soul at heart loved better than simple peace and quiet. For the rest, he was 50 or thereabouts, a little inclined to corpulence, a prepossessing face, unwhiskered and of an agreeable color, a rather full face, humanely intelligent in expression. On a fair day, with a fair wind and all going well, a certain musical chime in his voice seemed to be the veritable, unobstructed outcome of the innermost man. He had much prudence, much conscientiousness, and there were occasions when these virtues were the cause of overmuch disquietude in him. On a passage, so long as his craft was in any proximity to land, no sleep for Captain Graveling. He took to heart those serious responsibilities, not so heavily borne by some shipmasters. Now, while Billy Budd was down in forecastle getting his kit together, the Indomitable's lieutenant, burly and bluff, nowise disconcerted by Captain Graveling's omitting to proffer the customary hospitalities on an occasion so unwelcome to him, an omission simply caused by preoccupation of thought, unceremoniously invited himself into the cabin, and also to a flask from the spirit locker, a receptacle which his experienced eye instantly discovered. In fact, he was one of those sea dogs in whom all the hardship and peril of naval life in the great prolonged wars of his time never impaired the natural instinct for sensuous enjoyment. His duty he always faithfully did, but duty is sometimes a dry obligation, and he was for irrigating its aridity whenever possible with a fertilizing decoction of strong waters. For the captain's proprietor, there was nothing left but to play the part of the enforced host with whatever grace and alacrity were practicable. As necessary adjuncts to the flasks, he silently placed tumbler and water jug before the irrepressible guest, but, excusing himself from partaking just then, dismally watched the unembarrassed officer deliberately dilute his grog a little, then, tossing it off in three swallows, pushing the empty tumbler away, yet not so far as to be beyond easy reach, at the same time settling himself in his seat and smacking his lips with high satisfaction, looking straight at the host. These proceedings over, the master broke the silence, and there lurked a rueful reproach in the tone of his voice. "Lieutenant, you are going to take my best man from me, the jewel of him."
"Yes, I know," rejoined the other,
immediately drawing back the tumbler, preliminary to a replenishing.
"Yes, I know. Sorry."
"Beg pardon, but you don't understand, Lieutenant. See here now. Before I shipped that young fellow, my forecastle was a rat pit of quarrels. It was black times, I tell you, of all the rites here. I was worried to that degree of pipe had no comfort for me. But Billy came, and it was like a Catholic priest striking peace in an Irish shindy. Not that he had preached to them, or said, or did anything in particular, but a virtue went out of him, sugaring the sour ones. They took to him like hornets to treacle. All but the bluffer of the gang, the big shaggy chap with the fire-red whiskers. He, indeed, out of envy, perhaps, of the newcomer, and thinking such a sweet and pleasant fellow, as he mockingly designated him to the others, could hardly have the spirit of a gamecock, must needs bestir himself in trying to get up an ugly row with him. And Billy forbore with him, and reassured with him in a pleasant way. He is something like myself, Lieutenant, to whom aught like a quarrel is hateful. But nothing served so. In the second dog watch one day, the Red Whiskers, in presence of the others, under pretense of showing Billy just whence a sirloin steak was cut, for the fellow had once been a butcher, insultingly gave him a dig under the ribs. Quick as lightning, Billy let fly his arm. I dare say he never meant to do quite as much as he did, but anyhow he gave the burly fool a terrible drubbing. It took about half a minute, I should think, and Lord bless you, the lubber was astonished at the celerity. And will you believe it, Lieutenant, the Red Whiskers now really loves Billy. Loves him, or is the biggest hypocrite that I ever heard of. But they all love him. Some of them do his washing, darn old trousers for him. The carpenter is at odd times making a pretty little chest of drawers for him. Anybody will do anything for Billy Budd, and it's the happy family here. Now, Lieutenant, if that young fellow goes, I know how it will be aboard the rights. Not again, very soon, shall I, coming up from dinner, lean over the capstan, smoking a quiet pipe. Oh, not very soon again, I think. Aye, Lieutenant, you are going to take away the jewel of them. You are going to take away my peacemaker. And with that the good soul had really some ado in checking a rising sob. "Well," said the lieutenant, who had listened with his amused interest to all this, and now waxing merry with his tipple, "well, blessed are the peacemakers, especially the fighting peacemakers. And such are the 74 beauties, some of which you see poking their noses out of the portholes of yonder warship lying to for me," pointing through the cabin windows at the indomitable. "But courage, don't look so downhearted, man. Why, I pledge you, in advance, the royal approbation. Rest assured that His Majesty will be delighted to know that in time when his hard tack is not sought for by sailors with such avidity as should be, a time also when some shipmasters privately resent the borrowing from them of a tar or two for the service, His Majesty, I say, will be delighted to learn that one shipmaster, at least, cheerfully surrenders to the king the flower of his flock. A sailor who with equal loyalty makes no dissent. But where's my beauty? Ah!" looking through the cabin's open door. "Here he comes. And by Jove, lugging along his chest, Apollo with his portmanteau. Aye, man," stepping out to him. "You can't take that big box aboard a warship. The boxes there are mostly shot boxes. Put your duds in a bag, lad. Boot and saddle for the cavalryman. Bag and hammock for the man of war's man." The transfer from chest to bag was made, and after seeing his man into the cutter and then following him down, the lieutenant pushed off from the rights of man. That was the merchant ship's name, though by her master and crew abbreviated in sailor fashion into the rights. The hard-headed Dundee owner was a staunch admirer of Thomas Paine, whose book in rejoinder to Burke's Arraignment of the French Revolution had then been published for some time and had gone everywhere. In christening his vessel after the title of Paine's volume, the man of Dundee was something like his contemporary shipowner, Stephen Gerard of Philadelphia, whose sympathies alike with his native land and its liberal philosophies he evinced by naming his ships after Voltaire, Diderot, and so forth. But now, when the boat swept under the merchantman's stern, and officers and oarsmen were noting, some bitterly and others with a grin, the name emblazoned there, just then it was that the new recruit jumped up from the bow where the coxswain had directed him to sit, and waving his hat to his silent shipmate sorrowfully looking over at him from the taffrail, bade the lads a genial goodbye, then making a salutation as to the ship herself, "And goodbye to you, old rights of man." "Down, sir!" roared the lieutenant, instantly assuming all the rigor of his rank, though with difficulty repressing a smile. To be sure, Billy's action was a terrible breach of naval decorum. But in that decorum he had never been instructed, in consideration of which the lieutenant would hardly have been so energetic in reproof, but for the concluding farewell to the ship. This he rather took as meant to convey a covert sally on the new recruit's part, a sly slur at impressment in general,
and that of himself in especial. And yet, more likely, if satire it was in effect, it was hardly so by intention. For Billy, though happily endowed with the gaiety of high health, youth, and a free heart, was yet by no means of a satirical turn. The will to it and the sinister dexterity were alike wanting. To deal in double meaning and insinuations of any sort was quite foreign to his nature. As to his enforced enlistment, that he seemed to take pretty much as he was wont to take any vicissitudes of weather. Like the animals, though no philosopher, he was, without knowing it, practically a fatalist. And it may be that he rather liked this adventurous turn in his affairs, which promised an opening into novel scenes and martial excitements. Aboard the Indomitable, our merchant sailor was forthwith rated as an able seaman and assigned to the starboard watch of the foretop. He was soon at home in the service, not at all disliked for his unpretentious good looks and a sort of genial, happy-go-lucky air. No merrier man in his mess, in marked contrast to certain other individuals, included like himself among the impressed portion of the ship's company, for these, when not actively employed, were sometimes, and more particularly in the last dog-watch when the drawing near of twilight-induced reverie, apt to fall into a saddish mood which in some partook of sullenness. But they were not so young as our foretopmen, and no few of them must have known a hearth of some sort. Others may have had wives and children left, too, probably, in uncertain circumstances, and hardly any but must have acknowledged kith and kin, while for Billy, as will shortly be seen, his entire family was practically invested in himself. Though our new-made foretopman was well-received in the top and on the gun-decks, hardly here was he that cynosure he had previously been among those minor ship's companies of the merchant marine, with which companies only he had hitherto consorted. He was young, and despite his all but fully developed frame, in aspect looked even younger than he really was. This was owing to a lingering adolescent expression in the as-yet smooth face, all but feminine in purity of natural complexion, but where, thanks to his seagoing, the lily was quite suppressed, and the rose had some ado visibly to flush through the tan. To one essentially such a novice in the complexities of factitious life, the abrupt transition from his former and simpler sphere to the ampler and more knowing world of a great warship, this might well have abashed him, had there been any conceit or vanity in his composition. Among her miscellaneous multitude, the Indomitable mustered several individuals who, however inferior in grade, were of no common natural stamp. Sailors more signally susceptible of that air which continuous martial discipline and repeated presence in battle can in some degree impart even to the average man. As the handsome sailor, Billy Budd's position aboard the 74 was something analogous to that of a rustic beauty transplanted from the provinces and brought into competition with the high-born dames of the court. But this change of circumstances he scarce noted. As little did he observe that something about him provoked an ambiguous smile in one or two harder faces among the blue jackets. Nor less unaware was he of the peculiar favorable effect his person and demeanor had upon the more intelligent gentlemen of the quarter-deck. Nor could this well have been otherwise. Cast in a mold peculiar to the finest physical examples of those Englishmen in whom the Saxon strain would seem not at all to partake of any Norman or other admixture, he showed in face that humane look of reposeful good nature which the Greek sculptor in some instances gave to his heroic strongman Hercules. But this again was subtly modified by another and pervasive quality. The ear, small and shapely, the arch of the foot, the curve in mouth and nostril, even the indurated hand, dyed to the orange tawny of the toucan's bill, a hand telling of the halyards and tar-buckets, but above all, something in the mobile expression and every chance attitude and movement, something suggestive of a mother eminently favored by love and the graces, all this strangely indicated a lineage in direct contradiction to his lot. The mysteriousness here became less mysterious through a matter of fact elicited when Billy at the capstan was being formally mustered into the service. Asked by the officer, a small, brisk little gentleman, as it chanced, among other questions, his place of birth, he replied, "Well, please, sir, I don't know." "Don't you know where you were born?"
Who is your father?
God knows, sir. Struck by the straightforward simplicity of these replies, the officer next asked,
Do you know anything about your beginning?
No, sir. But I have heard that I was found in a pretty silk line basket, hanging one morning from the knocker of a good man's door in Bristol.
Found, say you? Well, throwing back his head and looking up and down the new recruit. Well, it turns out to have been a pretty good find. Hope they'll find some more like you, my man. The fleet sadly needs them.
Yes, Billy Budd was a foundling. A presumable by-blow, and evidently no ignoble one. Noble descent was as evident in him as in a blood horse. For the rest, with little or no sharpness of faculty or any trace of the wisdom of the serpent, nor yet quite a dove, he possessed a certain degree of intelligence, along with the unconventional rectitude of a sound human creature, one to whom not yet has been proffered the questionable apple of knowledge. He was illiterate. He could not read, but he could sing, and, like the illiterate nightingale, was sometimes the composer of his own song. Of self-consciousness he seemed to have little or none, or about as much as we may reasonably impute to a dog of St. Bernard's breed. Habitually being with the elements and knowing little more of the land than as a beach, or rather that portion of the terraqueous globe providentially set apart for dance houses, doxies, and tapsters, in short what sailors call a fiddler's green, his simple nature remained unsophisticated by those moral obliquities which are not in every case incomparable with that manufacturable thing known as respectability. But are sailors frequenters of fiddler's greens without vices? No. But less often than with landsmen do their vices so-called partake of crookedness of heart, seeming less to proceed from viciousness than exuberance of vitality after long restraint, frank manifestations in accordance with natural law. By his original constitution, aided by the cooperating influences of his lot, Billy in many respects was little more than a sort of upright barbarian, much such, perhaps, as Adam presumably might have been ere the urbane serpent wriggled himself into his company. And here be it submitted that, apparently going to corroborate the doctrine of man's fall, a doctrine now popularly ignored, it is observable that where certain virtues, pristine and unadulterate, peculiarly characterize anybody in the external uniform of civilization, they will, upon scrutiny, seem not to be derived from custom or convention, but rather to be out of keeping with these, as if indeed exceptionally transmitted from a period prior to Cain's city and citified man. The character marked by such qualities has, to an unvitiated taste, an untampered with flavor like that of berries, while the man thoroughly civilized, even in a fair specimen of the breed, has to the same moral palate a questionable smack as of a compounded wine. To any stray inheritor of these primitive qualities found, like Caspar Hauser, wandering dazed in any Christian capital of our time, the poet's famous invocation near 2,000 years ago of the good rustic out of his latitude in the Rome of the Caesars still appropriately holds. Faithful in word and thought, what has thee, Fabian, to the city brought? Though our handsome sailor had as much of masculine beauty as one can expect anywhere to see, nevertheless, like the beautiful woman in one of Hawthorne's minor tales, there was just one thing amiss in him. No visible blemish, indeed, as with the lady, no, but an occasional liability to a vocal defect. Though in the hour of elemental uproar or peril he was everything that a sailor should be, yet under sudden provocation of strong heart-feeling, his voice, otherwise singularly musical, as if expressive of the harmony within, was apt to develop an organic hesitancy, in fact, more or less of a stutter, or even worse. In this particular, Billy was a striking instance that the arch-interpreter, the envious marplot of Eden, still has more or less to do with every human consignment to this planet of Earth. In every case, one way or another, he is sure to slip in his little card, as much as to remind us, I too have a hand here. The avowal of such an imperfection in the handsome sailor should be evidence not alone that he is not presented as a conventional hero, but also that the story in which he is the main figure is no romance. At the time of Billy Budd's arbitrary enlistment into the Indomitable, That ship was on her way to join the Mediterranean fleet. No long time elapsed before the junction was effected. As one of that fleet, the 74 participated in its movements, though at times, on account of her superior sailing qualities and the absence of frigates, dispatched on separate duty as a scout, and at times on less temporary service. But with all this, the story has little concernment, restricted as it is to the inner life of one particular ship and the career of an individual sailor. It was the summer of 1797. In the April of that year had occurred the commotion at Spithead, followed in May by a second and yet more serious outbreak in the fleet at the Nore. The latter is known, and without exaggeration in the epithet, as the Great Mutiny. It was indeed a demonstration more menacing to England than the contemporary manifestos and conquering and proselytizing armies of the French Directory. To the Empire, the Nore Mutiny was what a strike in the Fire Brigade would be to London threatened by general arson. In a crisis when the kingdom might well have anticipated the famous signal that some years later published along the naval line of battle what it was that upon occasion England expected of Englishmen, that was the time when at the mastheads of the three deckers and 74s moored in her own roadstead, a fleet, the right arm of a power then all but the sole free conservative one of the old world, the blue jackets, to be numbered by thousands, ran up with hurrahs the British colours with the Union and Cross wiped out, by that cancellation transmuting the flag of founded law and freedom defined into the enemy's red meteor of unbridled and unbounded revolt. Reasonable discontent growing out of practical grievances in the fleet had been ignited into irrational combustion as by live cinders blown across the channel from France in flames. The event converted into irony for a time those spirited strains of Dibdin, as a songwriter no mean auxiliary to the English government, at this European conjuncture, strains celebrating, among other things, the patriotic devotion of the British tar. And as for my life, 'tis the king's. Such an episode in the island's grand naval story her naval historians naturally abridge. One of them, G.P.R. James, candidly acknowledging that fain would he pass it over, did not impartiality forbid fastidiousness. And yet his mention is less a narration than a reference, having to do hardly at all with details. Nor are these readily to be found in the libraries. Like some other events in every age befalling states everywhere, including America, the Great Mutiny was of such character that national pride, along with views of policy, would fain shade it off into the historical background. Such events cannot be ignored, but there is a considerate way of historically treating them. If a well-constituted individual refrains from blazoning aught amiss or calamitous in his family, a nation in the like circumstances may, without reproach, be equally discreet. Though after parleyings between government and the ringleaders, and concessions by the former as to some glaring abuses, the first uprising, that at Spithead, with difficulty was put down, or matters for a time pacified. Yet at the Nore, the unforeseen renewal of insurrection on a yet larger scale, and emphasized in the conferences that ensued by demands deemed by the authorities not only inadmissible, but aggressively insolent, indicated, if the red flag did not sufficiently do so, what was the spirit animating the men. Final suppression, however, there was, but only made possible, perhaps, by the unswerving loyalty of the Marine Corps, and a voluntary resumption of loyalty among influential sections of the crews. To some extent, the Nore Mutiny may be regarded as analogous to the distempering eruption of contagious fever in a frame constitutionally sound, and which anon throws it off. At all events, among these thousands of mutineers were some of the tars who, not so very long afterwards, whether wholly prompted thereto by patriotism or pugnacious instinct or by both, helped to win a coronet for Nelson at the Nile, and the naval crown of crowns for him at Trafalgar. To the mutineers, those battles, and especially Trafalgar, were a plenary absolution, and a grand one, for that which goes up to make scenic naval display is heroic magnificence in arms. Those battles, especially Trafalgar, stand unmatched in human annals. Concerning the greatest sailor since the world began, Tennyson. In this matter of writing, resolve as one may to keep to the main road, some bypaths have an enticement not readily to be withstood. Beckoned by the genius of Nelson, I am going to err into such a bypath. If the reader will keep me company, I shall be glad. At the least, we can promise ourselves that pleasure which is wickedly said to be in sinning. For a literary sin, the divergence will be. Very likely, it is no new remark that the inventions of our time have at last brought about a change in sea warfare in degree corresponding to the revolution in all warfare effected by the original introduction from China into Europe of gunpowder. The first European firearm, a clumsy contrivance, was, as is well known, scouted by no few of the knights as a base implement, good enough, peradventure, for weavers too craven to stand up crossing steel with steel in frank fight. But, as a sure knightly valour, though shorn of its blazonry, did not cease with the knights, neither on the seas, though nowadays in encounters there a certain kind of displayed gallantry befallen out of date as hardly applicable under changed circumstances, did the nobler qualities of such naval magnates as Don John of Austria, Doria, Van Tromp, Jean Bart, the long line of British admirals, and the American Decaturs of 1812 become obsolete with their wooden walls. Nevertheless, to anybody who can hold the present at its worth without being inappreciative of the past, it may be forgiven if to such a one the solitary old hulk at Portsmouth, Nelson's Victory, seems to float there not alone as the decaying monument of a fame incorruptible, but also as a poetic reproach softened by its picturesqueness to the monitors and yet mightier hulls of the European ironclads. And this not altogether because such craft are unsightly, unavoidably lacking the symmetry and grand lines of the old battleships, but equally for other reasons. There are some, perhaps, who, while not altogether inaccessible to that poetic reproach just alluded to, may yet on behalf of the new order be disposed to parry it, and this to the extent of iconoclasm, if need be. For example, prompted by the sight of the star inserted in the Victory's deck designating the spot where the great sailor fell, these martial utilitarians may suggest considerations implying that Nelson's ornate publication of his person in battle was not only unnecessary but not military, nay, savored of foolhardiness and vanity. They may add, too, that at Trafalgar it was in effect nothing less than a challenge to death, and death came. And that but for his bravado, the victorious admiral might possibly have survived the battle, and so, instead of having his sagacious dying injunctions overruled by his immediate successor in command, he himself, when the contest was decided, might have brought his shattered fleet to anchor, a proceeding which might have averted the deplorable loss of life by shipwreck in the elemental tempest that followed the martial one. Well, should we set aside the more than disputable point whether for various reasons it was possible to anchor the fleet, then plausibly enough the benthamites of war may urge the above. But he might have been is but boggy ground to build on. And certainly in foresight as to the larger issue of an encounter and anxious preparations for it, buoying the deadly way and mapping it out, as at Copenhagen, few commanders have been so painstakingly circumspect as this reckless declarer of his person in fight. Personal prudence, even when dictated by quite other than selfish considerations, is surely no special virtue in a military man, while an excessive love of glory, exercising to the uttermost the honest, heartfelt sense of duty, is the first. If the name Wellington is not so much of a trumpet to the blood as the simpler name Nelson, the reason for this may perhaps be inferred from the above. Alfred, in his funeral ode on the victor of Waterloo, ventures not to call him the greatest soldier of all time, though in the same ode he invokes Nelson as the greatest sailor since the world began. At Trafalgar, Nelson, on the brink of opening the fight, sat down and wrote his last brief will and testament. if, under the presentiment of the most magnificent of all victories, to be crowned by his own glorious death, a sort of priestly motive led him to dress his person in the jeweled vouchers of his own shining deeds, if thus to have adorned himself for the altar and the sacrifice were indeed vainglory, then affectation and fustian is each truly heroic line in the great epics and dramas, since in such lines the poet but embodies in verse those exaltations of sentiment that a nature like Nelson, the opportunity being given, vitalizes into acts. The outbreak at the Nore was put down, but not every grievance was redressed. If the contractors, for example, were no longer permitted to ply some practices peculiar to their tribe everywhere, such as providing shoddy cloth, rations not sound or false in the measure, not the less impressment, for one thing, went on. By custom sanctioned for centuries, and judicially maintained by a Lord Chancellor as late as Mansfield, that mode of manning the fleet, a mode now fallen into a sort of abeyance but never formally renounced, it was not practicable to give up in those years. Its abrogation would have crippled the indispensable fleet, one wholly under canvas, no steam power, its innumerable sails and thousands of cannon, everything, in short, worked by muscle alone. A fleet the more insatiate in demand for men, because then multiplying its ships of all grades against contingencies present and to come of the convulsed continent. Discontent foreran the two mutinies, and more or less it lurkingly survived them. Hence it was not unreasonable to apprehend some return of trouble, sporadic or general. One instance of such apprehensions. In the same year with this story, Nelson, then Vice Admiral Sir Horatio, being with the fleet off the Spanish coast, was directed by the admiral in command to shift his pennant from the captain to the Theseus. And for this reason, that the latter ship, having newly arrived in the station from home where it had taken part in the great mutiny, danger was apprehended from the temper of the men, and it was thought that an officer like Nelson was the one, not indeed to terrorize the crew into base subjection, but to win them by force of his mere presence back to an allegiance, if not as enthusiastic as his own, yet as true. So it was that for a time on more than one quarter-deck anxiety did exist. At sea, precautionary vigilance was strained against relapse. At short notice, an engagement might come on. When it did, the lieutenants assigned to batteries felt it incumbent on them, in some instances, to stand with drawn swords behind the men working the guns. But on board the 74, in which Billy now swung his hammock very little, in the manner of the men, and nothing obvious in the demeanor of the officers would have suggested to an ordinary observer that the great mutiny was a recent event. In their general bearing and conduct, the commissioned officers of a warship naturally take their tone from the commander, that is, if he have that ascendancy of character that ought to be his. Captain the Honorable Edward Fairfax Vere, to give him his full title, was a bachelor of 40 or thereabouts, a sailor of distinction, even in a time prolific of renowned seamen. Though allied to the higher nobility, his advancement had not been altogether owing to influences connected with that circumstance. He had seen much service, been in various engagements, always acquitting himself as an officer mindful of the welfare of his men, but never tolerating an infraction of discipline. Thoroughly versed in the science of his profession, and intrepid to the verge of temerity, though never injudiciously so. For his gallantry in the West Indian waters as flag lieutenant under Rodney in that admiral's crowning victory over de Grasse, he was made a post-captain. Ashore in the garb of a civilian, scarce anyone would have taken him for a sailor, more especially that he never garnished unprofessional talk with nautical terms, and grave in his bearing evinced little appreciation of mere humor. It was not out of keeping with these traits that on a passage, when nothing demanded his paramount action, he was the most undemonstrative of men. Any landsman, observing this gentleman, not conspicuous by his stature and wearing no pronounced insignia, emerging from his retreat to the open deck, and noting the silent deference of the officers retiring to leeward, might have taken him for the king's guest, a civilian aboard the king's ship, some highly honourable, discreet envoy on his way to an important post. But, in fact, this unobtrusiveness of demeanour may have proceeded from a certain unaffected modesty of manhood, sometimes accompanying a resolute nature, a modesty evinced at all times not calling for pronounced action, and which, shown in any rank of life, suggests a virtue aristocratic in kind. As with some others engaged in various departments of the world's more heroic activities, Captain Vere, though practical enough upon occasion, would at times betray a certain dreaminess of mood. Standing alone on the weather side of the greater deck, one hand holding by the rigging, he would absently gaze off at the black sea. At the presentation to him of some minor matter interrupting the current of his thoughts, he would show more or less irascibility, but instantly he would control it. In the Navy he was popularly known by the appellation Starry Vere. How such a designation happened to fall upon one who, whatever his sturdy qualities, was without any brilliant ones, was in this wise. A favourite kinsman, Lord Denton, a free-handed fellow, had been the first to meet and congratulate him upon his return to England from the West Indian cruise, and but the day previous, turning over a copy of Andrew Marvell's poems, had lighted, not for the first time, however, upon the lines entitled Appleton House, the name of one of the seats of their common ancestor, a hero in the German wars of the 17th century, in which poem occur the lines, "This 'tis to have been from the first in a domestic heaven nursed, under the discipline severe of Fairfax and the Starry Vere." And so, upon embracing his cousin fresh from Rodney's victory, wherein he had played so gallant a part, brimming over with just family pride in the sailor of their house, he exuberantly exclaimed, "Give ye joy, Ed, give ye joy, my Starry Vere." This got currency, and the novel prefix serving in familiar parlance readily to distinguish the Indomitable's captain from another Vere, his senior, a distant relative, an officer of like rank in the Navy, it remained permanently attached to the surname. In view of the part that the commander of the Indomitable plays in scenes shortly to follow, it may be well to fill out that sketch of him outlined in the previous chapter. Aside from his qualities as a sea officer, Captain Vere was an exceptional character. Unlike no few of England's renowned sailors, long and arduous service with signal devotion to it had not resulted in absorbing and salting the entire man. He had a marked leaning toward everything intellectual. He loved books, never going to sea without a newly replenished library, compact but of the best. The isolated leisure, in some cases so wearisome, falling at intervals to commanders even during a war cruise, never was tedious to Captain Vere. With nothing of that literary taste which less heeds the thing conveyed than the vehicle, his bias was toward those books to which every serious mind of superior order, occupying any active post of authority in the world, naturally inclines, books treating of actual men and events, no matter of what era. History, biography, and unconventional writers who, free from cant and convention, like Montaigne, honestly and in the spirit of common sense, philosophize upon realities. In this love of reading, he found confirmation of his own more reserved thoughts, confirmation which he had vainly sought in social converse, so that, as touching most fundamental topics, there had got to be established in him some positive convictions which he felt would abide in him, essentially unmodified so long as his intelligent part remained unimpaired. In view of the humbled period in which his lot was cast, this was well for him. His settled convictions were as a dike against those invading waters of novel opinion, social, political, and otherwise, which carried away, as in a torrent, no few minds in those days, minds by nature not inferior to his own. While other members of that aristocracy, to which by birth he belonged, were incensed at the innovators, mainly because their theories were inimical to the privileged classes, Captain Vere disinterestedly opposed them, not alone because they seemed to him incapable of embodiment in lasting institutions, but at war with the world and the peace of mankind. With minds less stored than his and less earnest, some officers of his rank, with whom at times he would necessarily consort, found him lacking in the companionable quality, a dry and bookish gentleman, as they deemed. Upon any chance withdrawal from their company, one would be apt to say to another something like this: "Vere is a noble fellow, starry Vere. Spite the gazettes, Sir Horatio is at bottom scarce a better seaman or fighter. But between you and me, now, don't you think there is a queer streak of the pedantic running through him? Yes, like the king's yarn in a coil of navy rope." Some apparent ground there was for this sort of confidential criticism, since not only did the captain's discourse never fall into the jocosely familiar, but in illustrating any point touching the stirring personages and events of the time, he would cite some historical character or incident of antiquity with the same easy air that he would cite from the moderns. He seemed unmindful of the circumstance that to his bluff company such allusions, however pertinent they might really be, were altogether alien to men whose reading was mainly confined to the journals. But considerateness in such matters is not easy in natures constituted like Captain Vere's. Their honesty prescribes to them directness, sometimes far-reaching, like that of a migratory fowl, that in its flight never heeds when it crosses a frontier. The lieutenants and other commissioned gentlemen forming Captain Vere's staff it is not necessary here to particularize, nor needs it to make mention of any of the warrant officers. But among the petty officers was one who, having much to do with the story, may as well be forthwith introduced. This portrait I essay, but shall never hit it. This was John Claggart, the master-at-arms, but that sea title may to landsmen seem somewhat equivocal. Originally, doubtless, that petty officer's function was the instruction of men in the use of arms, sword or cutlass. But very long ago, owing to the advance in gunnery, making hand-to-hand encounters less frequent, and giving to nitre and sulphur the preeminence over steel, that function ceased. The master-at-arms of a great warship, becoming a sort of chief of police, charged, among other matters, with the duty of preserving order on the populous lower gun decks. Claggart was a man of about 35, somewhat spare and tall, yet of no ill figure upon the whole. His hand was too small and shapely to have been accustomed to hard toil. The face was a notable one, the features, all except the chin, cleanly cut as those on a Greek medallion. Yet the chin, beardless as Tecumseh's, had something of the strange, protuberant heaviness in its make that recalled the prints of the Reverend Dr. Titus Oates, the historical deponent with the clerical drawl in the time of Charles II, and the fraud of the alleged popish plot. It served Claggart in his office that his eye could cast a tutoring glance. His brow was of the sort phrenologically associated with more than average intellect, silken jet curls partly clustering over it, making a foil to the pallor below, a pallor tinged with a faint shade of amber akin to the hue of time-tinted marbles of old. This complexion, singularly contrasting with the red or deeply bronzed visages of the sailors, and in part the result of his official seclusion from the sunlight, though it was not exactly displeasing, nevertheless seemed to hint of something defective or abnormal in the constitution and blood. But his general aspect and manner were so suggestive of an education and career incongruous with his naval function that when not actively engaged in it, he looked like a man of high quality, social and moral, who, for reasons of his own, was keeping incognito. Nothing was known of his former life. It might be that he was an Englishman, and yet there lurked a bit of accent in his speech, suggesting that possibly he was not such by birth, but through naturalization in early childhood. Among certain grizzled sea gossips of the gun decks and forecastle went a rumor perdue that the master-at-arms was a chevalier who had volunteered into the King's Navy by way of compounding for some mysterious swindle, whereof he had been arraigned at the King's Bench. The fact that nobody could substantiate this report was, of course, nothing against its secret currency. Such a rumor, once started on the gun decks in reference to almost anyone below the rank of a commissioned officer, would, during the period assigned to this narrative, have seemed not altogether wanting in credibility to the tarry old wiseacres of a man-of-war crew. And indeed, a man of Claggart's accomplishments, without prior nautical experience, entering the Navy at mature life as he did, and necessarily allotted at the start to the lowest grade in it, a man, too, who never made allusion to his previous life ashore, these were circumstances which, in the dearth of exact knowledge as to his true antecedents, opened to the invidious a vague field for unfavorable surmise. But the sailor's dog-watch gossip concerning him derived a vague plausibility from the fact that now, for some period, the British Navy could so little afford to be squeamish in the matter of keeping up the muster rolls that not only were press gangs notoriously abroad both afloat and ashore, but there was little or no secret about another matter, namely, that the London police were at liberty to capture any able-bodied suspect and any questionable fellow at large and summarily ship him to the dockyard or fleet. Furthermore, even among voluntary enlistments, there were instances where the motive thereto partook neither of patriotic impulse nor yet of a random desire to experience a bit of sea life and martial adventure. Insolvent debtors of minor grade, together with the promiscuous lame ducks of morality, found in the Navy a convenient and secure refuge. Secure because once enlisted aboard a king's ship, they were as much in sanctuary as the transgressor of the Middle Ages harboring himself under the shadow of the altar. Such sanctioned irregularities, which for obvious reasons the government would hardly think to parade at the time, and which consequently, and as affecting the least influential class of mankind, have all but dropped into oblivion, lend color to something for the truth whereof I do not vouch, and hence have some scruple in stating something I remember having seen in print, though the book I cannot recall, but the same thing was personally communicated to me now more than 40 years ago by an old pensioner in a cocked hat with whom I had a most interesting talk on the terrace at Greenwich, a Baltimore negro, a Trafalgar man. It was to this effect. In the case of a warship short of hands, whose speedy sailing was imperative, the deficient quota, in lack of any other way of making it good, would be eked out by drafts called direct from the jails. For reasons previously suggested, it would not perhaps be easy at the present day directly to prove or disprove the allegation. But allowed as a verity, how significant would it be of England's straits at the time, confronted by these wars, which, like a flight of harpies, rose shrieking from the din and dust of the fallen Bastille? That era appears measurably clear to us who look back at it, and but read of it. But to the grandfathers of us greybeards, the thoughtful of them, the genius of it presented an aspect like that of Camoens' Spirit of the Cape, an eclipsing menace, mysterious and prodigious. Not America was exempt from apprehension. At the height of Napoleon's unexampled conquests, there were Americans who had fought at Bunker Hill, who looked forward to the possibility that the Atlantic might prove no barrier against the ultimate schemes of this portentous upstart from the revolutionary chaos, who seemed an act of fulfilling judgment prefigured in the apocalypse. But the less credence was to be given to the gun-deck talk touching Claggart, seeing that no man holding his office in a man-of-war can ever hope to be popular with the crew. Besides, in derogatory comments upon one against whom they have a grudge or for any reason mislike, sailors are much like landsmen. They are apt to exaggerate or romance. About as much was really known to the indomitable tars of the master-at-arms career before entering the service as an astronomer knows about a comet's travels prior to its first observable appearance in the sky. The verdict of the sea quidnuncs has been cited only by way of showing what sort of moral impression the man made upon rude, uncultivated natures, whose conceptions of human wickedness were necessarily of the narrowest, limited to ideas of vulgar rascality. A thief among the swinging hammocks during a night watch, or the man-brokers and land-sharks of the seaports. It was no gossip, however, but fact that, though, as before hinted, Claggart, upon his entrance to the Navy, was, as a novice, assigned to the least honorable section of a man-of-war's crew, embracing the drudges, he did not long remain there. The superior capacity he immediately evinced, his constitutional sobriety, ingratiating deference to superiors, together with a peculiar ferreting genius manifested on a singular occasion, all this, capped by a certain austere patriotism, abruptly advanced him to the position of master-at-arms. Of this maritime chief of police, the ship's corporals, so-called, were the immediate subordinates, and compliant ones. And this, as is to be noted in some business departments ashore, almost to a degree inconsistent with entire moral volition. His place put various converging wires of underground influence under the chief's control, capable, when astutely worked through his understrappers, of operating to the mysterious discomfort, if nothing worse, of any of the sea commonalty.